Thank you, and it's wonderful to be here at St. Athanasius. This is my first visit here to your beautiful church and church to be, church of the future. Those of us who have grown up in Orthodox America over the last 50 or so years are aware that in American Orthodoxy, we have what may be described as musical pluralism. On the most basic level, the soundscape one hears in one Orthodox church in this country may be very different from what one hears in another church. And I would like to start off my talk just by illustrating that with two short musical examples. The communion hymn for Sundays, Praise the Lord in the Heavens. The same hymn sung in a totally different style. Even though that's a composition of rather recent times, it's very clear to anyone who hears that that's the sound of Slavic Orthodox singing. In some churches, such as St. Athanasius here, these soundscapes coexist. But from the outset of my talk, I would like to state for the record that both sounds have a very venerable history and tradition. Both are equally valid and legitimate. So the question I'd like to explore with you today is how these two fundamentally diverse styles came to exist. How did it happen that the Eastern Slavs, the ancestors of the modern-day Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, having accepted Orthodox Christianity over 1,025 years ago from the Greeks in Byzantium, together with the whole package of theology, liturgy, iconography, architecture, and liturgical chant, wound up singing their divine services in a manner that is so strikingly different. And as we examine this process, which as far as we can tell occurred over a period of some 600 or 700 years, I will be illustrating a few key musical landmarks by means of some recordings, which through the efforts of scholars and musicologically minded performing groups today are able to offer us a fascinating taste of the musical practices of long bygone eras as they bring to life again melodies and hymns that are many centuries old. After we conclude our historical odyssey, we will focus a bit on the present day situation in America. How the 1,000-year-old historical experience of the Eastern Slavs might be relevant to us today. And since there is no way I can effectively cover 1,000 years of musical development in the span of an hour and a half, there will be undoubtedly things that I will have left out. And so at the end, we will have time for some questions. Also, when you came in, you should have picked up a handout called Outline of History, Russian Choral Music, Outline of History. And that's just kind of something for you to take home as a memento, and you can scribble notes on the margins. Any account of the origins of sacred art and music among the Eastern Slavs must of necessity begin with that famous passage from the Russian Chronicle about St. Vladimir's envoys, which His Eminence mentioned already yesterday. I will just expand on that a little bit. In the 980s, the envoys were sent out by Prince Vladimir of Kiev to find a suitable new religion for his subjects. They were pagans at the time. They visited the Volga Bulgars, a tribe kind of related to the Bulgarians, but distantly. They lived on the Volga River, and they practiced Islam. Then they also visited the Khazars, another tribe that practiced Judaism. They visited the Germans, who practiced Roman Rite Christianity. And then they came to Constantinople, present-day Istanbul in Turkey, and they were taken to the great temple of Hagia Sophia, where they experienced Christian worship according to the Byzantine Rite, with chanting, icons, incense, and all taking place under that great dome that represented the span of the heavens. And this experience changed them profoundly, so that when they returned to Kiev, this is what they reported to the prince. And this is a quote from the Chronicle. "The Greeks led us to the edifices where they worshiped their God, and we knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. For on earth there is no such splendor or such beauty, and we are at a loss as to how to describe it. We know only that God dwells there among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations, for we cannot forget that beauty. Every man, after tasting something sweet, is afterward unwilling to accept that which is bitter, and therefore we can no longer dwell here," meaning in pagan Kiev, worshiping trees and rocks and other things that pagans worship. In his upcoming article, Beauty Will Save the World, soon to be published in a very wonderful publication. I don't know if many people are aware of it yet. This is a publication of the Western Diocese of Rokor, the Russian Church Abroad, called Spiritual Spring. There's an article there by Archimandrite Irenae Steenberg, who comments on this passage. And I quote, "It is important to recognize that these emissaries have intellectually understood little to nothing of what they were beholding during their first Orthodox service in this magnificent temple. They knew nothing of Christian theology, nor did they understand the language of the divine service, nor the culture or of the people. And what did they say? They did not say, we were moved by their faith, or we were impressed by their theology. But rather, they said, we knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. And in the midst of all the divine beauty they witnessed, they knew one thing above all else. We know only that God dwells here among men." End quote. I've dwelt on this passage a bit because whether it is a verbatim account or the stuff of legend, it is certainly true that this experience and description of divine beauty has been a central reference point for liturgical artists in Russia, musicians, iconographers, architects, and other artisans throughout the course of the next 1,000 years. Now, there were several other things that happened, important things that happened in connection with the conversion and baptism of the Eastern Slavs in the year 988. In another early chronicle, we read that with the baptism of Kievan Rus, the Byzantine patriarch sent a metropolitan along with priests, deacons, and chanters who were Slavs. Now, who were these Slavs? After all, the seat of the Orthodox Patriarchate was in Constantinople, in the Roman Empire. Well, these Slavs were Bulgarians who had converted to Christianity some 125 years earlier and had already developed a standing tradition of liturgical worship in their own native language, a language that, to use the 16th century English Archbishop Thomas Cranmer's famous phrase, could be understanded of the people. In this case, Church Slavonic. In this respect, the Eastern branch of what was then still the universal, united Christian Church was already then taking a different approach to missionary work than the Western Church of Rome. Whereas the latter used Latin throughout its domain, the Eastern Church translated the scriptures and liturgical books into the native language of the local people. So the conversion of the Slavs was one of the first major translation experiences, if you will, for the Eastern Church. And it also offers one of the first case studies in musical adaptation, whereby a tradition received from one nation in one language became transformed into another language and another culture over a period of time. How this all came to pass is a long and fascinating subject, and one that we don't really have time to get into today. If you're interested, it's discussed in detail in this book, which is volume 2 of Johann von Gardner's book, Russian Church Singing. We have two volumes, volume 1 and volume 2. The first one tells you about Orthodox worship and hymnography, how it's all set up, and this is the history of church singing in Russia from the origins until the year 1650. And we have a few copies available here in the bookstore. There are a few important observations we can draw from this process of translation, which are of particular interest to church musicians. When the Eastern Slavs received Byzantine Christianity, it was at the conclusion of a long, nearly 1,000-year period of liturgical evolution and development, by the end of which the format and content of the major services, the cycles of feasts, the liturgical books, all of that was already very well formed. Texts, of course, were in Greek, and many of them followed specific metric and poetic patterns, as was typical for Greek poetry, iambic, trochaic, and others. If you're a student of language and poetry, you know what those are. They're certain patterns of language. And the music that some of these poetic hymns were sung to also reflected metrically the metric organization of the text. You see? However, in translation, the primary focus had to be on the theological accuracy rather than on preserving the poetic meter. The translations made at that time gravitated in the direction of being literally accurate rather than employing what may be referred to as dynamic equivalence. In other words, a paraphrase that would have preserved the original thought, but mainly preserve the poetic meter. The result of the translation was, from Greek to Church Slavonic, was the loss of correlation between poetic meter and the musical meter. And melodies, therefore, had to be devised that were more flexible in character and able to accommodate a varied number of syllables. And this, in turn, contributed to the evolution of new melodies in the Slavic realm. So what do we know about the actual musical inheritance those early Slavs received from Byzantium? Based on surviving manuscripts, we know that there were at least two different types of chant. One was znameni. I'll write that word. Someone recently asked me, the neophyte to Orthodoxy, he says, is it true that in the Russian church they sing something called zombie chant? to be careful of your diction. Znamene is a more or less simple syllabic chant, at least it was then, used for singing the majority of the hymns of Vespers, Matins, and Divine Liturgy. It was notated by means of symbols called znamena. And therefore, you got the term znamene, notated chant. And then there was a second type of chant called Kandakarian chant. Which was predictably used to sing Kontakia. It was a much more elaborate melismatic chant that was sung by highly trained soloists, primarily in a few select cathedrals and chiefly on special festive occasions. And then probably there was still a third type of chant which existed in the oral tradition. And we might call it non-znamene chant because it was not notated. Used for the most common hymns, responses, litanies, Mercy of Peace, those kinds of things that are sung, and with thy spirit. And we have no way of guessing what that might have sounded like without an actual time machine, because these hymns, as again has been already mentioned, there was no need to notate them because everybody knew them. They were in the oral tradition. So we have znamene, we have kondikarian, and non-znamene. For the first two types of chant, we're very fortunate to be able to play you examples recorded by some of these intrepid musical scholar performers who will give you an approximate taste of what these liturgical singing may have sounded like in Kievan Rus some 900 or 1,000 years ago. This is the great doxology in Znamene chant. Understand the language to hear that there's about one note per syllable. Syllabic, that's an example of syllabic chant. The next example is Kondakarian chant, and this is a Kontakian for the exaltation of the cross, thou who was voluntarily lifted up on the cross for our sake. Here it's sung by a choir, a choice made by the particular performing ensemble. There's evidence that it would have been sung by a soloist. But here, anyway, is music 1,000 years old, and that's pretty impressive in and of itself. About these examples. The singing is completely in unison, which correlates with what the manuscripts tell us. There is only one line of musical symbols, which would point to unison performance. Unless there are some unwritten rules of performance practice, and that always makes for interesting guesswork on the part of musicians and scholars. If we continue to listen to several more examples of different hymns from different services, we would also notice that no matter what the specified tone of the selection, all the melodies would sound like they are based on the same scale or mode, not on different scales or modes as we know them today in the Byzantine tradition. Now, if you don't know about modes and scales, kind of don't worry about it. We don't really have time to explain that, but it has to do with the arrangement of the notes on the scale, the intervals. Father, you illustrated that a little bit today, whether you go or that's an example of two different modes. Well, all these chants of the early Slavs are on the same basic diatonic mode or scale. So, in the prevailing view of historians, much of the liturgical singing in Russia for at least the first five centuries, to about the year 1500, was in unison. And yet, during this very time, the innate sensibilities, the musical kind of instincts of the Slavic people had an effect upon the chant they had originally received from Byzantium. The various scales and modes which were prevalent in the Middle East somehow became attenuated and made more uniform according to what the Slavic ear was able and willing to perceive. But there's another very interesting area in which the musical sensibilities of the Slavic nation manifested itself. And this was the apparent tendency of the Eastern Slavs to sing in parts, or as we would say today, to harmonize. I sing a melody, and someone next to me doesn't sing the same melody, but they sing something else that makes pretty harmony together. But they might say, if you ask a folk singer, they might say, oh no, we're singing the same melody, exactly the same melody, just on two different levels, you see. So interestingly enough, there's a passage in the Russian Chronicles in which this phenomenon is also attributed to the Greeks. This account refers to an event that occurred approximately in the year 1051 during the reign of Prince Yaroslav the Wise, the grandson of St. Vladimir. And I quote from the Chronicle. In those days, three Greek singers, inspired by God, came to Yaroslav with their families. It is from them that angel-like singing, wonderful singing in the eight tones, as well as three-part sweet singing, and the most beautiful demestvini singing to the praise and glory of God originated in the Russian land. Now, there's much that can be said about this passage, and indeed, Professor Gardner devotes a good portion of Volume 2 discussing the various implications of that can be drawn from this account. What I'd like to emphasize in our presentation today is the mention of three-part sweet singing and the most beautiful demestvini singing, which certainly suggests something other than unison singing. Gardner points out that the most familiar version of this chronicle, the version that is cited by historians, dates from the 16th century, a time when liturgical singing in more than one part can already be documented from the sources. Perhaps, Gardner suggests, the 16th century editors of the chronicle were trying to justify or to lend legitimacy to a new manner of liturgical singing by attributing the origins to three Greek singers who had come to Kiev from Constantinople in the 11th century. Or, perhaps, some other type of improvised polyphony, singing in several parts, already existed much earlier among the Slavs. We know that things that are recorded in manuscripts that survive, they survive wars, they survive invasions, fires in wooden churches. They give only part of the picture, but there are things that usually exist much earlier and eventually are written down. Be that as it may, the manuscripts from the late 16th and early 17th centuries contain singing that is definitely more than one part, usually three, sometimes four. And again, thanks to relatively recent recordings, we can hear what this singing sounded like. Here is an example of a cherubic hymn in znamenī polyphony. Poly meaning many, phony parts, polyphony. What is striking to our modern Western ears about this type of singing is, first of all, its linearity. We have essentially three distinct melodies moving horizontally. And at the same time, there's an absence of what musicians refer to as functional harmony. In Western music of more recent times, when we hear chords, we're very accustomed to hearing them in a specific order and sequence. They tend to move in somewhat predictable ways according to rules worked out over several centuries, and they give the music a sense of order, predictability, and oftentimes, depending on the choice of chords, a certain emotional character or content. Whereas these chords sound somewhat unpredictable, being formed seemingly at random depending on the combined movements of the individual voices. So the question is, where might Russians have learned this type of polyphonic singing, so distinct and unlike the unison chants based on various modes received from Byzantium? And also, so unlike any type of polyphony that was prevalent in Western Europe at the time? Well, the totally honest answer to the question, where did it come from, is we don't really know. Although personally, I have a very strong suspicion that there might be a connection with the singing of the Church of Georgia. Listen now to an example of Georgian polyphony. Also, the singing of the Church of Georgia, which was founded in the 4th century, also had its roots in the Byzantine world, but since at least 11th or 12th century, it's been polyphonic in three parts, and it's characterized by some of the same lack of functional harmony, some of the same vertical combinations that arise seemingly at random by the movement of voices as znamenī polyphony in Russia. To listeners in the West, both of these types of chant sound exotic and otherworldly, perhaps for some of these very reasons that I've mentioned. They don't have a particular emotional character. They don't necessarily lead us from a place to place in a very predictable sort of way. So we think of them as exotic. And indeed, perhaps they are meant to be otherworldly. The account about the three Greek singers, in addition to three-part sweet singing, also mentioned the most beautiful demesthmene singing. I won't go into the origins of that word, demesthmene. There's lots of things that can be said about that. But as near as which, but we can tell one thing about demesthmene singing, that it was reserved for the most solemn festal hymns and services held in the most important cathedrals. Here's what polyphonic demesthmene singing sounded like, again, dating from the late 16th century in Russia. This is the doxastikon for the Nativity of Christ. Today Christ is born of a virgin in Bethlehem. Now, compared to Znamenae polyphony, in demesthmene polyphony, there's an even greater independence of voices. The voices move in different directions and also at different rhythms, which very often results in harsh and dissonant clashes to our ear. When in the 19th century, Russian musicologists first figured out how to transcribe demesthmene manuscripts, many of them couldn't believe what their eyes and ears were telling them. The 19th century Russian music historian Vladimir Odoyevsky wrote in 1876, "The assumption that these three parts were ever intended to be sung together simultaneously is out of the question, as there is not a single coordination, the slightest coordination in harmony, the parts being completely separate. No human ear could ever endure such a succession of sounds occurring all the time." And a century later, the music historian Alfred Swan invoked the opinion of composer Ralph Vaughan Williams by saying, "Singing is the foundation of what is right and wrong in music. You can make the clarinet and flute play wrong notes together, but you could not sing the C major scale if someone next to you was singing in B major." Well, that's Ralph Vaughan Williams, great student of folk music. That's his opinion. But clearly, as these recorded examples illustrate, it is possible to sing what may at first sight seem to be wrong notes. What is more, as musicologists emerged out of their ivory tower studies and went out into the field with recording equipment, they found isolated communities living in the far-flung reaches of Russia where they recorded and transcribed folk singing that sounded remarkably like demesthmene polyphony. This is a folk song transcribed in the 1980s somewhere in Siberia.
Ой, где ж ты был, шельма пробывалый?
while we're on that subject, here is the same group of people singing Gladsome Light, also recorded in the 1980s. Occasion to spend some time with the late Russian folklorist Dmitry Pokrovsky shortly before his untimely death in 1996 at the age of 52. He was preparing a book on Russian folk polyphony, and he said to me, as he was showing me this complex multi-voice transcription the size of an orchestra score, he said, "Where did this kind of singing come from in Russia? I certainly don't know," and he'd been studying it all his life. "It's just like it fell down from the sky somehow." Well, what can we say, or rather what we can say positively about this type of singing is that quite apart from the unusual sound, which results, if we were to get into the musical analysis, has to do with the simultaneous sounding of fourths and fifths rather than the superimposition of thirds. Those musicians among you will understand what I'm talking about. We make chords by putting a third above a third above a third. But if you take a fourth and a fifth, then what happens at the top is you get a second, a dissonance, into our modern-day ears. But that this singing, regardless of how the technical part of it is put together, is that the music does not seem to engage our senses or our emotions. And in that sense, we can say that it is otherworldly in that regard. Perhaps it evokes the sound of clanging Russian bells with their complex overtone series. Perhaps it is an attempt to depict by earthly means some sort of heavenly singing which no ear has ever heard. So the first 650 years of liturgical singing in Russia, approximately to the year 1650, may be referred to appropriately as the era of chant, because even the polyphony during this time preserved the characteristic linkage between text and music that typifies chant. And before we leave the realm of unison chant, I would like to call upon our resident singers to come up here, and we're going to sing for you an excerpt from a hymn from Vespers called A Theotokion Dogmatikon. It's a hymn honoring the Virgin Mary, and it focuses on the dogma, hence the term dogmatikon, of the incarnation of Christ, drawing a number of parallels or between the prophecies or types in the Old Testament that pointed to the faithful people of Israel what God's plan was for their salvation. Here's the text. I will read you the text. "In the Red Sea of old, a type of the Virgin Bride was prefigured. There, Moses divided the waters. Here, Gabriel assisted in the miracle. There, Israel crossed the sea without getting wet. Here, the Virgin gave birth to Christ without seed. After Israel's passage, the sea remained impassable. After Emmanuel's birth, the virgin remained a virgin." Mm-hmm. just us.
In the Red Sea of old, the type of the virgin bride was prefigured. There Moses divided the waters. Gabriel assisted in the
Now, remember what you just heard. If you were following along, you noticed that the analogies or parallels in the text were highlighted by means of parallel or similar phrases in the melody. And since it was in English, hopefully that was obvious to you. So we're going to return to this hymn momentarily again. But as I just said, the middle of the 17th century represents a major watershed in the development of Russian liturgical singing because three major developments occurred at this time. Number one, the unison znameni chant of the variety we just heard, as well as the native Russian polyphony, the znameni and demestveni, were supplanted by a totally different type of music, harmonic part singing according to Western European principles of harmony and counterpoint. The second development was that new melodies were introduced, which were rather strikingly different in their structural relationship to the sacred text. And finally, the overall cultural aesthetic attitudes towards music underwent a rather radical change from what had been the case the preceding 650 years. It's generally acknowledged that the reign of Emperor Peter I, who reigned from 1682 to 1725, was a time of tremendous cultural change in Russia, a major move towards westernization in all aspects of life. In the history books, he's generally referred to as Peter the Great. But church historians will point out that for the Orthodox Church, Peter was not so great. Among other things, he abolished the office of the patriarch and made the church essentially a department of the secular government, following Lutheran and Anglican models that he had observed during his travels in Western Europe. But in the realm of liturgical singing, most of the momentous changes I just mentioned occurred actually in the reign of Peter's father, Tsar Alexis Mikhailovich, who reigned from 1645 to 1676. To understand the magnitude of these changes, we must briefly touch upon the developments that took place in southwestern Rus, known by this time as Ukraine, in the late 16th and early 17th centuries. Well, in that part of the world, after the initial blossoming of faith, culture, and education that followed the baptism of Kievan Rus under Prince Vladimir and his grandson, Prince Yaroslav the Wise, a period of feudal fragmentation ensued as successive generations of princes divided the realm and engaged in internecine warfare. Then in the mid-1200s came the devastating Mongol or Tatar invasions, following which the southwestern region, which included Kiev, the original cradle of Russian and Christian culture, came under the political control of Roman Catholic Poland and Lithuania for several centuries If you look at maps of that time, you will see that Poland and Lithuania were much larger, much more important countries than they are now. Eventually, in that the Vatican politicians got involved, and they offered the Orthodox in the region to enter into administrative union with Rome. Such an unia occurred in 1596, giving rise to what are now known as the Uniate, or Eastern Rite Catholic or Greek Catholic churches. Well, one of the things that attracted the Orthodox faithful to the Uniate church was the beauty and splendor of the vocal polyphony and organ music. This was the era when the Western church delighted in the works of Palestrina, Lassus, Victoria, and other Renaissance masters. I remember when I sang those pieces in, one of the reasons I became a choral musician was singing those works in high school and college. I said, there is nothing more beautiful in this world. This is what I want to do with my life, is sing beautiful choral music. Well, to counteract this factor, Orthodox clergy and lay brotherhoods adopted the Western-style music for Orthodox services. And some of those adaptations can be heard in Russian churches to this very day. Fighting fire with fire, as it were, the Orthodox established schools, trained singers, and commissioned new works from new composers. But ironically, the only models that they could follow, both educationally and culturally, were Latin. Instead of being trained in the art of composing znamenny chant, the singers and composers were trained in the graceful art of musikia. The singing they performed was referred to as partesni singing, or singing in parts. Partes, and they added partesni, making it an adjective. And among the musical pieces that they adopted was a type of strophic paraliturgical Polish Catholic song called a cant, from the Latin word cantus, meaning song. So notice the utterly Latinized vocabulary here, musikia, partesni, cant. In contrast with the polyphonic music sung in city cathedrals, Polish cants can be likened to carols, which is one reason that in Ukraine, to this day, there's a tremendously large repertoire of them. They're short, musically simple, and often contain many verses or strophes set to the same melody. A similar type of pieces can be found in numerous European countries: Germany, Italy, Holland, France, Romania, England, both among Roman Catholics and Protestants, and Orthodox. Among the Catholics, they are typically non-liturgical, used outside the church for processions and festivals. Whereas among the Protestants, these types of songs, sometimes referred as chorales or hymns, they set the pattern for a large percentage of the selections that make up a typical congregational hymnal. One simple melody, many, many strophes, sung in a rather simple, metered-like fashion. Well, in the 17th century, not only were a number of Polish Catholic cants adopted in various ways by the Orthodox for liturgical use, but more importantly, the simple musical structure and texture of cants became a hallmark new style of Orthodox liturgical singing. And because they were so simple by comparison with znamenny chant, and because they had such a pleasant sound to the ear, they quickly spread throughout Ukraine and Russia to parish churches and monasteries, as well as cathedrals in major cities. We'll call upon our resident singers again to illustrate for you. We will actually recreate for you how a cant is put together musically. And we're going to do this with a cherubic hymn. We're going to use a melody called The Thief Beheld. And here is the genesis of this piece of music, as we can tell. The text, the thief beheld. Oh, am I shut off now? Okay. As near as... Sorry. As near as we can tell, the text the thief beheld is the troparion for the ninth hour on Holy Friday. And the text is, the thief, seeing the Prince of Life hanging on the cross, said, if he who is crucified with us here were not God incarnate, the sun would not have hidden its rays, nor would the earth, the shaken earth, be quaking. But you who hear all things, remember me, Lord, in your kingdom. Although this hymn is designated to be sung in Psalm 8, somewhere along the line, it came to be sung to a relatively simple one-phrase melody, which was written down in the style of Znamenae Polyphony. We'll hear a few bars of this. Widespread technique of contrafactum, another good Latin word. This hymn was taken and used for the cherubic hymn, perhaps because it was also used for the cherubic hymn of Great and Holy Saturday. This was from the service the day before. So if you take the words, let all mortal flesh keep silent, and put it to the words, the thief beheld, to the tune, the thief beheld, you've done a contrafactum. And from that, it's just another short step to go to the cherubic hymn of normal divine liturgy, which is exactly what Nicholas Custer, the choir director from St. Seraphim's Orthodox Church in Santa Rosa, has done here. He's taken this and done and taken it to English and put it to the words of the cherubic hymn. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have, just like we rehearsed, the ladies, if you would sing the melody. They'll just sing one phrase of the melody, and we'll illustrate how a cant is put together. No. These similarities between what we heard there and the thief beheld, okay? So everybody would kind of know this melody, the thief beheld, you know, it evokes associations. But since we're good Slavs, we don't like to sing in unison anymore. We like to harmonize. So we're going to ask our soprano to add a voice above the melody. And to this part, then, we add a bass to these two parts, a bass part that can almost be improvised by any experienced singer. The notes of the two top voices kind of suggest what the bass part perhaps ought to sound like. So with the bass part now, and three parts. Yeah. that's left, since we have a fourth voice, is to kind of fill in the chords. It's called a filler part. And sometimes it falls to the tenor, sometimes it falls to the alto. You know, if you're one of those, when you have to sing the filler. And let's continue now, past to the next cadence. So what we see in the Kant style is essentially a simplification of the part writing, a set formula that's applied to the melody in a very specific, predetermined fashion, rather than somewhat unruly, unpredictable, squirmy part writing of this nomine polyphony, or to say nothing of the even more flamboyant demesthene polyphony. Well, in the 17th century, a similar process occurred with respect to the construction of the melodies of the eight tones, those eight categories of melodies into which a vast majority of Orthodox liturgical texts are organized. Instead of each hymn having a complex, more or less unique relationship of the text to the melody, as we heard in the Znamenae Theotokion Dogmaticon in the Red Sea, the hymns of the eight tones came to be sung to much simpler melodies, comprised of a fixed sequence of one, two, three, rarely four or five phrases, repeated as many times as necessary. The Finnish musicologist Jopi Hari has termed this style of chant phrasal chant. Phrase from the word phrase, phrasal chant. Now, even in the early Znamenae chant books, there were different styles of melody. There were melodies that were melismatic, as we already noted, in which a syllable of text might have many, many different notes, and melodies that were syllabic, where for each syllable of text there was just one note, rarely two or three. Melismatic melodies naturally took more time to sing, and they were generally reserved for festive occasions or processions when a hymn had to occupy a certain amount of time. By contrast, syllabic melodies were used for daily services where the singing had to be more efficient, as it were. So in the Znamenae chant books, there were great Znamenae melodies and there was lesser Znamenae chant. Well, in the 17th century, as perhaps the tempo of life was beginning to accelerate, even then, the lesser syllabic chants came to be more widely used. And this was especially true in the southwestern Rus, Ukraine, where the lesser Znamenae chant developed into a local variant called Kievan chant. You see the connection, Kievan, from the city of Kiev. And here is how, quartet, if we could ask you again, this is how the dogmatic in the fifth tone in the Red Sea of old sounds in Kievan chant.
Divided the waters. Here
assisted in the miracle. There Israel crossed the sea without getting wet. Here the virgin gave birth to Christ without seed. After Israel's passage, the sea remained impassable. After Emmanuel's birth, the virgin remained a virgin. Ever existing God who appeared as man. O Lord, have mercy on us.
Thank you. Don't go away too far. We're going to continue. We notice here that the three phrases repeated as many times as necessary to accommodate the text is what the hymn is made of. But what happens in the process is that those textual statements comparing the Old Testament events and the New Testament are no longer sung to musically parallel statements. The delivery of the text is more efficient in some respects, more syllabic, and perhaps on some level the words are more clearly understood. But on another level, the correlation between the text and the melody is definitely missing, and the depth of meaning is in some sense diminished. To this greatly simplified phrasal melody, it was very easy to apply the simple Kant style of harmonization that we just did with the cherubic hymn. Let's do it this way. Let's start off, if we can, let's start off with just the melody, and then sing that for three phrases, and then we'll add the harmony, the soprano. Is that too complicated to do it that way? So we'll add the soprano, and then we'll add the bass, and then we'll end with with all four parts. So.
In the red.
In the Red Sea of old, a type of the Virgin Bride was prefigured. There Moses Jesus divided the water.
Okay, now add the soprano.
Gabriel assisted the miracle. Then Israel crossed the sea without getting wet.
Now add the bass.
After Israel's passage, the sea remained impassable. After Emmanuel's birth, the virgin remained a virgin. Oh, ever-existing God who appeared as matter. Oh,
have the anatomy of four-part chant harmonized Kant style. Thank you, quartet. We'll be right back with our next installment. As the 17th century progressed, more and more musical cultural influence from Ukraine penetrated Muscovy. Traveling ensembles of professional Partesny singers found a favorable reception in the courts of Tsar Alexis and the Patriarch of Moscow. Patriarch Nikon, who was patriarch only from 1652 to 1658, but whose short tenure had a profound effect on the Russian church, in fact decreed that all singing in his chapel should be of the Partesny variety. Patriarch Nikon also undertook the correction of Russian Orthodox liturgical books, and to help accomplish this, he invited Greek scholars to Moscow. They were very eager, by the way, to come to Moscow because already life in the Church of Constantinople was rough after the fall of Constantinople. And so the great patron and protector of the Orthodox was now the Russian emperor. So all things Greek were in vogue at this time, and melodies sung by those visiting Greek scholars were written down and adopted into the codex of Russian chant books. Many of these same melodies remain in use to this day. We will illustrate, if the gentleman would come up, we will illustrate how these Greek melodies might have been recast from their Byzantine origins into a more familiar Russian flavor. So we will sing a few phrases of Bless the Lord, O my soul, which is the opening psalm from Vespers, or from actually All Night Vigil. Just in unison right now.
Bless the Lord, O my soul. Blessed art thou.
Here is what it might have sung. When the Greeks sang it, it might have sounded like this. Who wants to be sung? Mm-hmm.
Blessed art thou, Lord, blessed art thou.
Well, to this, the Russians applied cant harmony, and this is what came out. So,
words are easy.
With words.
Bless the Lord, O my soul. Blessed art thou, O Lord, blessed art thou.
See, exactly the same formula that we applied before. Third above. Bass part that sort of improvisatory. In fact, it's not written here. You're just making it up by
sure.
Your ear. Okay, and now if we can ask the ladies, we can sing a four-part arrangement now of this same thing. We'll just continue singing as written from the bottom here.
Soprano, alto, bass, tenor.
Bless the Lord, my soul. Bless the Lord, my soul.
And singers at that time could pretty much do that on the fly almost from chant books. Let's see, there's some fascinating connection between these type of Russian-Greek chant melodies and authentic Byzantine melodies, which I don't think has actually been sufficiently explored. At the same time, I think it's important to differentiate the Russian-Greek chants rather than simply calling them Greek melody, as sometimes one sees in modern-day adaptations. Well, at the same time the Russians adopted the Greek chants, they also adopted a number of melodies called Bulgarian chants, which became widely used for certain hymns. Here is one of the best known examples of Bulgarian chant.
Oh,
Bulgarian chants tend to be melismatic, many notes per syllable, but they usually only have one phrase, which repeats over and over. The texture of the arrangements is essentially that of Kant style. You have a melody, you have a part singing in thirds above, you have a bass part and a filler part. So again, they are another aspect of the trend towards simplification that we observe in the 17th century. So along with the entry of this onto the scene of new and simpler chants, the Kievan, the Russian Greek, and the Bulgarian, another, I mentioned, three developments. And here is what this third development was. One of the leading music theorists of the time, the Ukrainian composer Nikolai Deletsky, who was trained in Roman Catholic Poland, set forth some radically different ideas concerning the art of musical composition. Contrary to the thinking that had prevailed for nearly seven centuries, when the composer of chant was also, in many cases, the author of the text, well, according to Deletsky, the art of the composer consisted first and foremost of inventing what he called fantasies, that is to say, tunes, independently of any text. When a fantasy comes to you, he writes in his treatise on musical composition, write it down without text and save it for use in concerts. If it doesn't fit one text, it will fit another. And consequently, as another music historian, Preobrazhensky, puts it, creativity was simplified. The composer was not required, as before, to penetrate deeply into the substance of his nominee chant, or to maintain a link with the internal content of the text. The new style freed the hands of any musically gifted singer to create melodies that had no connection with the melodic treasures accumulated over the centuries, but were rather naive in their simplicity and incredibly impoverished both in rhythm and overall structure by comparison with the objective yet profound znamenny melodies. We already saw this when we contrasted the znamenny chant setting of In the Red Sea with the Kievan chant setting. And now we're going to look at some examples that further illustrate Preobrazhensky's point and Deletsky's principle of taking a melody independent of any text and using it for another purpose. We'll trace the genealogy of one of the most common melodies in latter century Russia, a melody that in fact was the only one given for the cherubic hymn in the Book of Harmonized Common Chant at the Imperial Court in St. Petersburg. I will play for you the original Polish Catholic cant. It's called Radujsya, radość twoju wospiewaju, rejoice, I hymn your joy. And it's a hymn to the Virgin Mary. It goes like this.
Radujsya, radość twoju wospiewaju, tak korki smutok moi poznaju. Radujsya, dziewo, radujsya,
okay, now if we can have our quartet, we're going to sing, again, adapted into English. Naturally, what suggests when you have a choice, a hymn that sings, rejoice, I hymn thy joy. Well, we have a communion hymn that says, rejoice in the Lord, all you righteous. Radujtesya, pravednye Gospodi. And this is exactly what was done in Slavonic. Same adaptation, here it is in English.
Rejoice in the Lord, all you righteous, praise befits the just. Rejoice in the Lord, all you righteous, praise befits the just.
Okay, thank you. Then the Russian composer, late in the 19th century, the Russian composer Rimsky-Korsakov took and applied the technique of contrafactum and put this melody to the words of the cherubic hymn. And the same Rimsky-Korsakov, again using the technique of contrafactum, now, and losing all connection with rejoice, as it were, sets it to the Sunday Communion hymn, Praise the Lord from the Heavens.
Praise the Lord!
Continues to the same tune. Thank you, quintet. So this illustrates the principle of the same melody being used for many different texts. And we pick just one example. Throughout the repertoire, we can find many, many examples of this type of use of borrowed melodies, melodies borrowed from other hymns, all kinds of all employing the technique of contrafactum. Well, we've devoted quite a bit of time to these various developments in the 17th century, not only because of the magnitude of the changes that they brought about, but because these changes and the trends that they set in motion are still very much with us in 21st century America. For a certain portion of 17th century Russian society, however, these changes were too much. When in the 1650s, Patriarch Nikon set out to correct certain erroneous liturgical practices and textual mistakes that had crept into Russian Orthodox worship, this brought him into open conflict with conservative elements in the church, who believed that the way to preserve true belief and true worship, orthodoxy, was to change nothing. And thus came about the violent and tragic rift in the fabric of Russian Orthodoxy, the schism of the old believers or old ritualists. In point of fact, this was a rift between the God and church-centered order of old Rus' and the new order of the Russian Empire, which was permeated by ever-increasing doses of secular humanism from the West. The old believers, who were branded as outlaws, fled to the outer reaches in entire communities, either beyond the borders of Russia or the remote wilds of Siberia, far from the long arm of the law, where they continued to preserve the unison's nominee chant to this day, and providing a fascinating opportunity for scholars to study their singing in a kind of time warp. That earlier recording that I played of Gladsome Light, those were old believers in Siberia singing in Dumestvenny polyphony that they have preserved for 300 years in the oral tradition, by and large. Here in North America, there are communities in Erie, Pennsylvania, in Oregon, in Alaska, and Mexico. At least those are the ones that I'm familiar with. Patriarch Nikon's liturgical reforms were ultimately accepted as correct and necessary by the mainstream Russian Orthodox Church, but the heavy-handed manner in which he implemented them caused him to be deposed from the patriarchal throne. To do this required the judgment of at least two other Eastern patriarchs, and so it happened that in the year 1666, two patriarchs, Paisios of Alexandria and Makarios of Antioch, traveled to faraway Moscow in order to preside over a council that would hold court over Patriarch Nikon. That was not a trivial journey in those days. While they were in Moscow, a group of parishioners from one of the prominent Moscow churches put before them the question, is the new style of Kievan and Greek chant, especially the newly composed Partesny singing, permissible in the Russian Orthodox Church, even though it was not received from the Eastern Church? Now, we don't know to what extent the two patriarchs, one a Greek and one an Arab, were how well versed they were in all the various new styles that had developed in Ukraine and Moscow over the past several decades. But we do know, and we have a written document, where they gave their approval and blessing, saying that they saw no reason why polyphonic singing in parts could not be used for Orthodox divine services. And so, with the retreat of the old believers and the approval of the Western-style part singing by the Eastern patriarchs, a path was opened in Russia to a massive influx of new compositions based on Western European models. Hymns that were formerly performed in the serene and stately style of Znamenny Chant were entirely recast using all the devices of Western European polyphony: imitation, repetition, multiple choirs, contrasts between soli and tutti. Listen to a little bit of an example of a work by Vasily Titov, one of the most prominent composers of the late 17th, early 18th century. This is The Angel Cried. Twelve voices, three choirs, one on a part. Some of you may know the ensemble Chanticleer, which is all men, by the way, singing soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Very authentic, because we know that there were ensembles of 12 singers that kind of traveled around and offered their services to the emperor and to the patriarch. So this is actually a rather remarkably accurate representation of what that music sounded like. Now, because of time constraints, we can only make brief mention of the developments of the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. We're kind of on the downhill stretch here, so bear with me just a few more minutes. the break that occurred in the mid-17th century from the old chant aesthetic received from Byzantium set in motion a couple of processes. On the one hand, Russian Orthodox church music began mirroring the various stylistic trends and changes that were occurring in Western European music, such as classicism, romanticism, and other movements in that same stylistic changes along those same veins. On the other hand, there began a process of historical study of church music known as liturgical musicology, and a critical self-examination which sought to define a unique national identity and a return of church singing to more traditional Orthodox roots. We see that same process in iconography, by the way. You have a period of Western captivity where icons become looking just like Western paintings. And then in the late 19th, early 20th century and into the 20th century, there's a true revival of understanding iconography in its true sense, and a whole school of iconographers that arose writing in a more traditional fashion. Well, in the 18th century, the new capital of St. Petersburg that was built by Emperor Peter became enamored with Italian opera, which was the rage all over Europe. A series of Italian composers were invited to the imperial court to stage operas and to train both instrumental and vocal musicians. And in the latter half of the 18th century, Russian composers were also sent to Italy for musical training. One of the most well-known of these was Dmitri Bortnyansky, who lived from 1751 to 1825, and who turned out to be a distinguished director of the imperial court chapel. Bortnyansky was also responsible for composing a number of sacred choral works, some of which are still in use to this day, perhaps in this very parish. I don't know. I know of other parishes. I know a little parish up in Van Nuys here. I directed them a number of years ago. The only cherubic hymn they knew was Bortnyansky's number 7. The late 18th and early 19th century was also a period when church choirs became prevalent in Russia. Before that, church singing was performed mostly by small ensembles, either one voice to a part, or in small towns and villages by just a solo chanter. But as the Imperial Chapel Choir, under Bortnyansky's leadership, developed in one of the world's finest choirs, it begat imitators. Pretty soon, every bishop and archbishop, as well as every nobleman of means, wanted to have their own choir, just like the Emperor's choir in the capital city. Well, this development spawned a great deal of amateurism and dilettantism, especially among composers. The nobility would train their serfs to become choristers, and they would invite some second or third rate maestro from Italy to direct them, and maybe the lord of the manor tried his own hand at composing some church music. Well, all sorts of semi-literate amateur works came to be composed for the church in styles were totally inappropriate for liturgical use. And so, in the early 1800s, Emperor Alexander I issued a decree that said all sacred works intended for the church first had to be approved by the director of the Imperial Chapel, Bortnyansky. And remember that the chapel was a department of the government. So here you have a secular composer appointed by, who served at will of the emperor, essentially acting as censor in all matters relating to church music. On the positive side, in 1772, the first complete collections of unison chants were printed by the Holy Synod of the Russian Orthodox Church. And these are the so-called square note chant books, because the notation in them was square as opposed to round notes, a little bit similar to Gregorian chant notation. And these contained all the hymns for the entire liturgical year, all the cycles, all the feasts, all the triodia, etc. Prior to that, all church singing had circulated in manuscript form. But except for the old believers, unison singing was no longer mainstream in the Orthodox churches, unless, of course, there was a single chanter. But more than likely, small groups of singers sang from these chant books, improvising in the same sort of Kant-style harmony that we examined earlier in three or four parts. Eventually, in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, these harmonies were standardized, resulting in what we now know as the common Russian imperial chant, or obichod. You may have seen that in some books. Very few people know what that means, but obichod simply means Book of Common Chant. This obichod, by imperial decree, was printed at government expense, and copies of it were deposited in every single church in the Russian Empire, with the requirement that if any member of the extended royal family was present at a service, all the singing had to be done according to this obichod. Naturally, this contributed greatly to its spread, including churches here in America that were established by Russian immigrants and refugees. The system of sacred music censorship, which was instituted by necessity in the early 19th century, became more and more restrictive as the century wore on. The successors to Bortnyansky in the Imperial Chapel, Alexei Lvov and Nikolai Bakhmetyev, were not inclined to approve anybody's works except their own. And so in the 40 years from 1831 to 1871, only 18 new sacred compositions by other composers were approved. And thus, despite the fact that in the realm of secular music, a vibrant new school of Russian nationalist composers was emerging, these composers were scarcely inclined to write for the Orthodox Church. Now, all this changed rather abruptly in 1878, with the composition of Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky's Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. Tchaikovsky's great achievement lay not so much in the actual music that he wrote for the church, some of it's not particularly distinguished, but simply in the fact that he was the first composer in the 19th century of major stature to pay any attention to composing for the Orthodox Church. And he even fought a court battle over it. The imperial director, director of the imperial chapel, had the right to censor works composed for liturgical texts. Or did he? When the director of the imperial chapel, Bakhmetyev, attempted to block the publication of Tchaikovsky's liturgy and to confiscate all existing copies, Tchaikovsky's publisher, Jurgensen, sued and won the case. Went all the way to the Russian Supreme Court. The ruling said that liturgical text had to be cleared for accuracy by the Office of Sacred Censorship, but the director of the imperial court chapel could not disallow the publication and performance of a sacred work merely on the grounds of musical style. Tchaikovsky himself modestly dismissed his own achievements in the field of church music. What is needed, he wrote in one of his letters, is a messiah who with a single stroke would destroy all the old conventions, and by this he meant the Italian and German style music that had permeated the Russian church, and would strike out along a new path, but that path consists, said Tchaikovsky, of returning to venerable gray-haired antiquity. In other words, to Kievan, Russian Greek, Bulgarian, and even Znamenny chant that had been discarded in favor of the new polyphonic music. The messiah called for by Tchaikovsky turned out to be Alexander Kostaisky, who lived from 1856 to 1926. He was a student of Tchaikovsky's, who became professor and eventually director of the Moscow Synodal School of Church Singing. A remarkable composition or institution, the like of which there has not been ever before or since. It was disbanded in 1917 with a coming of communism. But imagine an institution of higher learning, a university or a conservatory dedicated to church music exclusively. And so began with Kostaisky, in what is in some respects the most glorious first chapter in the history of Russian church singing, a period of about 25 years from the late 19th century to 1917, during which several dozen prominent composers wrote settings for over 40 major cycles, complete liturgies and vigils, as well as close to 1,000 individual works for Orthodox worship. Some of these works, such as Tchaikovsky's liturgies, Rachmaninoff's Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom and his All-Night Vigil, Gretchaninov's Passion Week, have entered the mainstream of choral repertoire and continue to be performed and recorded by choirs worldwide, Orthodox as well as non-Orthodox, after being, while other works, after being suppressed and neglected for 70 plus years of communism, are only beginning to be rediscovered now. I was involved in a revival, or actually the first performance of a work that was written in 1922 by a composer named Maximilian Steinberg, a setting of Passion Week, entirely based on Znamenny chant, and this work had never been performed from the time it was composed until Capella Romana performed it in Portland in April of this year. So there's still things, treasures that have been lying completely forgotten and waiting for rediscovery. The main appeal and attraction of these works of the New Russian Choral School is that they represent a wonderful synthesis between the realm of traditional chant and the sonorous possibilities of a full, unaccompanied chorus of human voices, a unique blending of the best that the East and the West have to offer. At Musica Russica, my publishing company, we've been publishing this music for over 25 years, and we can clearly attest that Russian Orthodox sacred choral music has an extraordinary appeal to choirs of all levels, from children, high school, college, professional groups, community groups, and in many corners of the world, from South Africa to Singapore, even to Beijing. And with these performances, even in non-liturgical settings, these choirs convey to their audiences a portion of the message of St. Vladimir's envoys. We knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. And what can we say about Orthodox church singing in America? What relationship does it have to anything that I've said today? Well, it's my belief that both on the practical and the theoretical level, the 1,000-year historical experience of the Russian church has a great deal to offer to the development of Orthodox liturgical singing in America. Several points to think about. For one thing, lest anyone argue that it is not possible to translate hymnography from the original language, or that liturgical worship can only be carried on in certain sacred languages, the experience of the Russian church clearly shows that it is not only possible to translate the texts themselves. After all, Church Slavonic was at one point a kind of a new kid on the block in the language, among languages used in worship, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, perhaps. But also, it's possible to adapt the musical settings in such a way that they sound natural and idiomatic. It's a process that takes a long time. It took probably several hundred years, but it nevertheless did take place. The experience of the Russians also demonstrates the possibility of adapting Orthodox liturgical singing to the natural musical sensibilities of another culture. What we saw as the Russians' natural propensity to sing in parts led to the development of chant-based polyphony, and eventually a blending of Western European elements with Orthodox chant. This has extremely important consequences for missionary outreach. If one is doing missionary work in a culture such as North America, chances are that people's ears have a greater affinity for singing in harmony than to singing in unison or in exotic modes with microtonal tuning. In Africa, in Southeast Asia, or in South America, different musical sensibilities might prevail. Another point, for several centuries, Russians walked the difficult path between free composition and strict adherence to canonical chant, there are lessons to be learned here as well. The Russian repertoire offers numerous examples of both good and bad creativity. Good chant arrangements and bad free compositions, but also the other way around. Bad chant arrangements and good free compositions. And any aspiring composer of Orthodox liturgical music stands to learn a great deal from studying the Russian liturgical repertoire in all its aspects, which is available now in an increasing number of recorded examples and publications. And finally, although a great many Orthodox churches in North America sing either the original Russian repertoire in Church Slavonic or English adaptations of it, there is still a lot of repertoire that awaits discovery and adaptation. So I hope my talk today will encourage you to explore it, each in your own way, whether you're a conductor, a teacher, a pastor, a choir singer, or simply a lover of beautiful sacred singing. And I thank you, and I hope we have some time for some questions. And thank you to our resident singers and to Valerie, upon whom I sprung this music in the last few days. And with all the other preparation that had to go on, they still managed to prepare that so beautifully. Thank you.